Welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 54. I'm Max Flight. With me is co-host Dan Webb. Hello, Dan.
Good evening, everyone.
And also the other co-host is returning for the second week in a row, Rob Mark. Hello, Rob.
Are you just saying that because Dan has been on all three of them now and this is only my second?
Scores
well,
3-2.
Well, I have perfect attendance, Rob.
Okay, all right. Yes. Good evening, all.
Today's guest is Ben Schlappig. He's from the 1 Mile at a Time blog, and welcome, Ben.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Ben.
Just a few quick administrative items. Want to make sure everyone visits our website, airplanegeeks.com, to check out the comments. Please leave your own comments. Take a look at the other comments that other folks have left and contribute to the conversation. Also wanted to mention that you can hear parts of this podcast on Flightline Internet Radio. I think that's right, Rob.
Correct.
Very good. All right. Well, we have an awful lot of news tonight coming out of a pretty busy week. And so why don't we jump right in and get started?
Sounds like a good idea.
Let's go.
I'm ready.
First article comes from ATW Online. This is Boeing delays 787 first flight again, cites excessive stress in upper wing joint area. Boeing delayed the 787 first flight, citing a series of relatively small areas on both sides of the aircraft's body in the upper wing joint area that registered stress levels during static testing that exceeded expectations. The article goes on, Commercial Airplanes President and CEO Scott Carson said the manufacturer determined Friday that without reinforcing these areas, the 787 would have to be operated in such a small envelope that it wouldn't be worth it to start a flight test program that would not be particularly useful to prepare the aircraft for certification. The company did not set a new target date for the first flight, saying only it will announce a new schedule in, quote, several weeks. It did not say whether or how long the first delivery to ANA, slated for the first quarter of 2010, would be delayed. Is this a small problem, or do you think this is a large problem?
I think a problem like this at this stage of the game is short. Ugly doesn't even cover it, I would imagine, but that's just my two cents.
Well, I think that this is, I agree, I think this is... It could turn out to be significant. This is an area in the composite structure, I think, where the wing and the wing box join, and the stress levels were found to be beyond what the models had predicted, and it's sort of a back to the drawing board kind of scenario, I guess.
Sure, and why is it that they're just finding that out now? I mean, the airplane's about ready to fly, and they're just now finding something sounds odd. I mean, how many people want to take a bet that this thing won't even fly in 2009?
Ouch. That would be nasty.
Ooh. I don't know.
Meanwhile, there is a celebration at Toulouse for those running the A350
yeah,
program.
Certainly.
Yeah. And who would have ever thought in the A350 development department that they could have ever even, you know, shrunk that distance between the 787 and the 350? I mean, they just thought that airplane was going to be out so late, and now that distance is shortening day by day.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and that's a big problem. That's a competitive issue for Boeing. Well, it's interesting, you know, the level of computer modeling that goes into the design of these aircraft, you know, as you might suspect, is pretty significant. And you know, this time around, the modeling is being applied to different material than has been the case most often in the past. So I don't know, maybe the computer models are less proven. It's kind of hard to say, but if it's a major redesign or any kind of a significant redesign, going back to the manufacturer of the composite components, this could represent a pretty significant delay.
You know, it's funny too, what we were talking about around the couch here this last week is that imagine how much Boeing thought it was going to win in terms of money, in terms of dollars saved by farming all this work out across the world, the risk sharing, the goodwill they were going to get, And if they had it to do over again, I wonder if the 797 will be built the same way.
Yeah, and in this economic environment, I think it's even worse, the effect with airlines possibly wanting to cancel orders or, you know, airlines trying to cut costs where they can. So I think this is also the worst possible time for, you know, such a thing to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ben.
Could actually some airlines not care about the delay in a sense? Could it be a good, could almost be a blessing in disguise for some airlines having these aircraft?
Oh, I think so.
Hopefully when the economy is better.
They didn't want to spend the money anyway right now.
So. What's the return policy here? Is it like Neiman Marcus or, I mean, you know, with a delay like this?
Well, you have to have something to return.
Can they cancel their orders, you think, without a fee if it's, you know, if there's a serious delay now, or what are the rules?
I'll bet you they can. I mean,
it may give them a free push out.
But think of it too. I mean, for the companies that say, no, wait, you know what? We'll let Boeing swing on this one a little bit. We get the benefit because we don't have to take delivery of an airplane as soon as we thought we would. And we can pester Boeing for money, whining that they didn't meet their deadlines. And then so don't they sort of win all the way around?
Yeah, they kind of do, right. Rob. And you know, another group that's really impacted by this is the leasing companies. And there have been a couple of articles about that out.
There is a good article about this in the Wall Street Journal. And obviously this completely affects their contracts. And apparently, the delays for the entire program, not just this one, have really helped apparently the market value of the A330 in the leasing market.
Yeah, and there are big players in the market. The Wall Street Journal says that the leasing companies own about a third of the world's 16,000 jetliners. A smaller percentage of the Boeing 787 orders on the books. I think it said that the leasing companies account for a sixth of the Dreamliner orders on the books. But that's big.
Yeah, but then there's that ugly news, too, about those issues related to the Air France crash and the A330, which have also got to be putting people in kind of an awkward position saying, gee, maybe we should have a 330, but, you know, maybe we need to have, you know, have second thoughts about that as well.
Yeah, it's a tough time. Okay, moving on to the next story, we see from the San Francisco Chronicle that Clear Service for Flyers abruptly shuts down. Clear Lanes, the business that promised to zip airline passengers through security for a fingerprint and a fee, ceased operations, redirecting its customers to the back of the line and leaving them with a lightened wallet. The service shut down after parent company Verified Identity Pass of New York failed to reach an agreement with creditors. This, of course, is the service that promised to move passengers, primarily frequent flyers, through security, sort of on an expedited basis, by virtue of being on record, being in the database in advance, and having been, you know, fingerprinted and issued an identity card. And apparently that's the business case for this is kind of fallen apart a little bit. Ben, you pass through airports an awful lot. Do you think this is going to have a big impact or any impact at all?
I mean, I think the first issue with this idea was I'm a 1K with United, which is their top tier status. So I get access to the priority security lines as it is. So I don't really see the value that much in such a service. It definitely cut the waits at major airports, but other than that, I just really don't think, you know, it was justifiable, you know, for someone to spend $300 or $200, whatever it costs a year. I don't think it's going to have a major effect on, you know, the wait times. We might see more people now buying access to the elite lines. Like, I already see United advertising on their website. The headline is, clear lanes have closed, but priority lines are still open. So United's obviously trying to profit off of this. But, I mean, the idea, I would love to see what their internal presentation was like, because I can't imagine they really thought out this business plan in terms of how many people they would need to break even.
Well, I think what really held it up is the TSA was never completely on board with this. And that while I think in theory eventually it's be scan your card, okay, we've done this intense background check, you're okay, it essentially just became a kind of concierge service, which is the way I've heard it described. It was basically just cut to the head of the line.
What's interesting, though, is I have seen, which is really cool, clear passengers cut in front of, like, flight attendants and pilots where, you know, they already get to go to the front of the line, but I've seen the clear agents, I guess, push right in front of the pilots. So, I mean, it certainly was expedited service, and it pissed off a lot of the crew members. But, you know, I guess that didn't pay off, or people weren't willing to pay the price.
Well, the basic model of the thing is kind of peculiar in that it's saying that, okay, we have an inefficient system, an inefficient process for getting passengers through security. So instead of fixing that, let's create a shortcut, around that, which still leaves the same problem. Isn't it better just to, instead of dividing passengers into, those that pay extra and those that don't, just say a passenger's a passenger, and how can we make this process as efficient as possible so everybody gets through? That makes more
You're
sense
expecting this from the government?
It's funny. I was just going to say the same thing.
I'm giving them too much credit.
There's a reason that Clear is a private company, I think.
Yeah, because the government has to be – well, what would the government – what would the TSA have called it if they ran it? They wouldn't call it Clear. They'd probably call it slow or
– not as slow.
Cumbersome or something like that. I don't know. Anyway.
Speaking of the government, moving on to the next story. This is from USA Today. FAA panel to develop rules on pilot fatigue by September. Airlines, pilot unions, and federal officials have until September 1st to develop new rules to limit fatigue among pilots, the FAA said Wednesday, in an unusually aggressive move to reach agreement on one of the industry's most contentious safety issues. The NTSB has cited fatigue as a factor in several recent crashes, including a February crash near Buffalo that killed 50 people. So basically the FAA is saying, okay, you airlines and pilot unions, we want you guys to start to meet with us actually in July and come up with recommendations on how long pilots can work each day.
I'm just going to go out on a limb here and predict that the airlines and unions are going to disagree on this issue.
And you know what the worst part is that there are – I'm sorry. I'm not an NRA member, but it sounds a little bit like the gun thing where people say we don't need new gun laws. We just need to enforce the ones that we have. And I heard a story about fatigue the other day from a United pilot and the difference between the rest rules, because there are federal regulations that say you must have X number of hours of rest between flights, and that's in black and white. However, it's the fact that the airlines have taken it upon themselves to interpret exactly when the rest period begins. For United guys, the rest period begins when they're in the hotel and they slam the door. Kapoom. Now your minimum 9 hours of rest begins. For the regional guys, it can start as early as 15 minutes after the airplane touches down. I mean, the airplane may not even be put away yet, and they're actually working on their rest time. And so, again, that's the part the feds need to get involved in, at least I believe. Not coming up with new rules, but making certain that everybody sees the rule the same way, which for FAA is going to be no small task.
Do you think that it's the 9 hour rule itself that's the problem? Or, one example I like to use is I frequently fly a Tampa to Washington flight. It's the 5:40 a.m. flight, and it's staffed by Los Angeles flight attendants. They get in the night before, Los Angeles pilots as well. They get in the night before at 8 p.m. They have over 9 hours of rest, but then they work a 5:40 a.m. flight. That's 2:40 a.m. in Los Angeles. And, as you can imagine, they probably got no sleep the night before because, it's hard to go to bed at, 8 or 9 p.m. on the East Coast when you're from the West Coast. So, I think they're technically they have everything that's within, the requirements. But at the same time, are they really getting any rest?
I think that's a very, very valid point because the computer system that schedules crews, pilots, flight attendants, what have you, does not see, wait a minute, Ben came in from L.A. last night. All it knows is Ben is free to staff a flight at 5:40. Get in there. And that's all they care about. So yes, I think that's a very valid point. I don't know that they're going to do it, but that is indeed part of the problem.
Okay, moving on to our next story. This comes from the Daily Mail. Terrified tourists boycott Thomas Cook flight home after being told to sit it back to help balance the jet. When holidaymakers were asked to sit at the back of the plane to balance heavy luggage in the front of the hold, many thought it was a bad joke. But it was a serious request. One of the doors to the hold was jammed, meaning bags could only be loaded at one end, making the plane nose heavy. However, the call for passengers to act as human ballast towards the tail provoked panic, and 71 refused to board. This sounds like it was a hysterical disaster.
I thought it was a joke story the first time I saw the headline. No joke.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, I've been on flights where, on regional planes, smaller planes, where passengers have been asked to redistribute a little bit. But apparently we have a series of events that sort of kicked off this extreme reaction. I guess that the passengers waiting to board observed the passengers departing from the same aircraft, and they were actually told by these passengers not to get on. It was the worst flight they had ever had. Said people were kissing the ground and putting their hands together like they were praying. There were girls sobbing and children crying.
That must have been because of the Thomas Cook service.
Something like that.
Well, really, when you think about it, what was the big deal? There's some piece of this story that we don't have. I mean, because I'm sorry, I have a very difficult time understanding how it got from, I'm sorry, we need to redistribute the load, so we're blocking the first five rows of seats and choose any seat you want, but you need to sit back there. I just somehow don't see, how many people? 70?
Yeah, 71.
71, yeah.
So there must have been some viral effect or something where
that's what I was thinking.
Because I can imagine once or twice maybe one person getting off, a crazy person, but 71 people, that's insane.
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly there had to be some – the airline is not completely blameless in this, I think. There had to be some failure in communication, at least on their part.
Maybe the pilot phrased something poorly, like I don't even know what, but I mean someone –
put all the fatsos in the back.
I don't know why this deserves such media attention.
We're going to get letters about that, aren't we? I'm sorry. It was Rob that said that, so don't pick on the other guys. It was me, so – okay, sorry.
Speaking of media attention, our friend Michael O'Leary is back in the news again from the Telegraph.
How could it get worse than paying to go to the John?
Well, he does. He says he wants passengers to carry all their bags on the plane. Michael O'Leary, the chief executive of Ryanair, has outlined plans to axe checked-in luggage. Under the plan, passengers would drop all but one bag at the aircraft steps, possibly paying £5 per bag for each placed in the hold. Now, this is a quote from Mr. O'Leary. What it means is no more waiting at the carousel, no more losing your bags, no more wasting your life in overpriced airport terminals. O'Leary just keeps finding ways to get back in the news.
You know, and the worst part is that you could almost see some of his business thinking in some of this, but then you always wonder, is he making this stuff up? Come on,
along.
Is he just doing – yeah, well, of course, his press guy said that he is, but the press guy's probably in on all of this as well, I'm sure.
Does this mean no more liquids when you fly, or does this have to go through security? I assume the bags have to go through, so can you not take any liquids over?
That's an interesting thought. I hadn't even considered that. Yeah. How will you be able to carry wine from that you brought back from wherever?
Well, perhaps the most interesting thing to me, anyway, in this article, at least is coming from the mouth of O'Leary, was his opinion as to how much longer the recession is likely to last. He said that he thinks that the U.S. will emerge in 2010. He said Europe in 2011 and Britain and Ireland after that because their borrowing is much worse.
And, you know, he had a couple of other great lines, once again, not related to the bag thing, but we'll just listen to this. Mr. O'Leary said he had abandoned any thoughts of retiring. Quote, "This is so much fun. I love recessions. You get to kick the bleep out of everybody. It's the boom times that are boring." And then later, talk. How do I say that word? Is that pilloried?
Pilloried, yeah. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Cool. Good ads, outtake to show how dumb I am. And also,
that's why you're in college.
Later on, the article goes, the Ryanair boss also pilloried Virgin founder Sir Richard Branson, who claimed over the weekend that British Airways could go bust. It's like a little chihuahua barking at a dying Labrador. Nobody cares.
You got to love the guy.
He's fair. But, you know, if I can just throw in one very interesting thought that no one has raised, being from Chicago, it was Mrs. O'Leary's cow that knocked over the lantern that started the Great Chicago
That's
Fire.
True.
Now, I wonder if this is some long-distant relative Yes. I just thought I would throw that
that's
in.
Okay, but that's good.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Tell you the truth, I would hate to work in the PR office for Ryanair. Like, how many angry emails do you think they get?
It's never, I'm sure it's never
it's an interesting story.
And with all the stuff that he's saying, how many just weird questions from reporters do they get?
No one's sleeping on that job, that's for sure.
At the same time, does anyone really blame Ryanair when, like, you know, for the negative changes, when you think of just how crazy they are? It's not like United where, you know, they make minor changes which are somewhat ridiculous, but all their changes are outrageous.
Yeah, that's true.
But what do the passengers think? I mean, think about what we just – that other story we just had about 71 people going berserk over being asked to move to a different place in the cabin. And this does not make people nuts? Wow.
To be honest, I kind of want to fly Ryanair because of all the stuff I've read about them.
I would do it once.
You got to see what's going on.
I did it once. That was all I wanted to do.
Okay, moving forward, the Chicago Tribune reports airlines jacking up summer airfares. Procrastination may prove costly for travelers with a yen to see the world this summer. Since Wednesday, airlines from Chicago to many cities in Europe have skyrocketed for flights taken through mid-August, the prime summer travel period for American families with school-age children. It looks like we're seeing a bit of a trend in the ratcheting up of fees.
You know why that is. You're all supposed to say, no, why is that?
No, why is that, Rob?
No, why is
that? Because the airlines have realized they're not making any money. And so, you know, all the hubbub, and they just kind of got lost in the shuffle that they're not making any money taking people where they want to go with the fees that they're charging. So,
yeah, I mean, there's no expectation that airfares are supposed to stay constant.
That's right.
Well, my one concern about this is, could this mean that maybe demand is making a bit of a comeback and they can start charging higher fares again? But at the same time, with oil rising, do the airlines, are they at a situation now where they say, well, we have to raise fares to cover cost? One's good, one's really bad.
Demand coming back, I don't know. I would almost tend to think it's because the capacity has been so significantly reduced.
Yeah,
there
same.
Are so many fewer seats that they can do a little bit more of what they want. I'm sure it's some of all of those things, but...
I monitor fares pretty closely, and I noticed literally, it seems, when summer started, which was last week, the fares just skyrocketed. And the amazing thing was, up until then, in the beginning of June, I flew probably 20 or 30 flights, and it was insane. Every flight was 100% full, if not oversold. So it seemed that up until that point, they were really filling the planes. Unfortunately, for them, it was mostly with low fares, but the load factor was very high. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they can sustain that load factor with these higher fares or whether they're going to budge a bit.
Well, just to go back to what Rob said with the capacity, I still think it's scary that they had to cut fares that much when you see someone like United drop, what was it, 100 aircraft? I don't think they're all gone, but it's
yeah,
that number, right, Ben? I think, 94 737s and
767s? That's about it. Yep, that's true. It's crazy how much they've cut capacity, and I think that's also why, especially United, every one of their flights is packed.
But you know something I don't understand is I was just talking to an American pilot, and American is still short of pilots right now, but they're going to lay off, I think, 1,000 flight attendants. How does that – I'm trying to think of how those numbers come together in my mind, that you have too few pilots to fly the flights, but you still need to keep laying off flight attendants. How'd that happen? Boy.
Maybe they're going to absolute minimum staffing and they weren't before.
Yeah, that could be.
Well, this might be my ignorance here, so feel free to mock me, but...
Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
Dan.
We're supposed to wait until you say something. Okay, I'm sorry.
Generally, I know it's only a small number of aircraft, but I know Americans dumping the A300, so how many pilots would that be, and how many flight attendants would that be? Because there would be more flight attendants than pilots, right?
That's true.
That's one thing I'm thinking of.
One flight attendant for every 50 people. And
the A300s, they just have two flight attendants.
For all 270 people.
Yeah, and one of them's the pilot as he runs out the door. So, no, it is. I was just curious. It's just so odd, but anyway.
I mean, at United, the 650 layoffs, they make sense because they're reducing staffing. Like the ex-Ted planes had 156 seats, and they're converting those, and they're going to have 150 or 140 something seats. So they only need three flight attendants now, and then they dumped all the 737s. But for American, it's a bit of a mystery, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. See, there was nothing to mock you on. See, wasn't that good?
It was pitch, wasn't it, Dan?
Yeah. I feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Let's go to the next story.
Hey, Max, don't you think that's a good thing that you have people saying that the show makes them feel warm and fuzzy?
I live for warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
You should put up some testimonials or something.
Ever since I started co-hosting, my self-confidence has skyrocketed.
Really?
That's
a lot of skyrocketing.
That's the whole idea. We, this whole podcast is for your self-confidence,
well,
Dan.
It's just like this recording, it's like an hour of, I don't know, male bonding. Did I take
Bromance.
That too far? I'm sorry.
Hey, Max, did you tell him, though, that when you edit the show that you put his voice through one of those synthesizers so he sounds like Darth Vader so no one will know it's him? Okay, you didn't tell him that. Okay, sorry.
And I think I forgot to mention that I'm not going to be doing any editing on this episode.
Oh, great. Oh, fantastic. Great.
Yeah, you just wait. All right, next story is on the green front. This comes from the ATA as a press release or a press article. Airlines reaffirm environmental commitment. The ATA, the Air Transport Association of America, which is the industry trade organization for the leading U.S. airlines, issued the following statement in response to the passage of the Waxman-Markley climate change bill, which I think was passed by the House, still waiting Senate action.
It passed on Friday by, I think it was less than 10 votes.
Yes, that's right. It was very close. And the ATA says, well, that they're not really in favor of this. The quote is, "The nation's airlines have an impressive environmental record and are committed to working with the administration to address climate change. But we have strong concerns about the Waxman-Markley bill and its punitive one-size-fits-all approach." And this comes from ATA President and CEO James C. May. Quoting again, "This cap-and-trade bill creates an onerous fuel tax on the airline industry." He says, the ATA says, "Fuel costs will skyrocket, hindering the ability of U.S. airlines to continue to improve their environmental performance through fleet modernization and technological advances, weakening their ability to compete in the global markets." So I guess what they're saying is we don't need an artificial stimulus to become more fuel efficient and reduce carbon emissions. And I guess everybody else in the world thinks differently.
Well, I have to go with the ATA on this one. I mean, the airlines have been working to improve efficiency by themselves because conveniently being more efficient. Well, on a side note, I love how airlines have said, oh, we've reduced emissions by this much. I think that they're more concerned about saving on their fuel bill than saving the environment. But regardless, airlines are busy working, if it's investing in new aircraft and dumping older ones or doing things like putting on blended winglets. And I know, I'm not sure if other airlines have done this. I know Southwest has been optimizing their cruise speeds on certain flights to save on fuel. So I think the airlines are doing all they can right now. I don't think they need an additional burden for this.
At the same time, though, isn't it high oil prices that caused United to retire 100 aircraft?
Yeah.
Talk about environmental or oil savings or environmental friendliness.
But, well, I guess the airlines are saying if you add this tax in addition to it, it'll just make it worse.
Right.
There's an interesting letter from May to Nancy Pelosi, who is, of course, the Speaker of the House, that details the ATA's logic behind being in opposition to this. And he mentions the things that we've just said, is that the fuel costs represent a large proportion of industry costs for airlines, and so they already have that economic incentive, that the industry has shown that it can continue to make changes even when the price of fuel drops. He also claims that we no longer have any low-hanging fruit to improve our efficiency, maybe. And then the next point, which sort of resonates with me, is that a country-by-country patchwork of inconsistent and overlapping greenhouse gas regulation schemes simply does not work for commercial aviation. And I think that's true. I think that's very true that, as you know, we've said in the past several times, commercial aviation is it's a global enterprise, and having different regional, you know, credits and systems and you know, forcing functions for greenhouse gas reduction, it really doesn't work. You really need one kind of global framework for this, it would seem to me.
And I don't think that exists anywhere. And no. When we were at the show in Paris a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about that. But the drumbeat out of the European Union is so intense to do something about the environment that, as one airline person told me, he said, I don't think it makes any difference to them whether they get it right or not. They want to be able to go back to the community and say, look at what we're doing. Now, whether it kills us in the process, I don't know that they really care, because it is very, very disorganized for the Europeans, and they're closer to the heart of this. That's kind of what forced it on the Americans. I don't think the Americans are ready for it, but you know, we kind of had it jammed down our throats.
I think the ATA, I think the best point they make in May's letter is that the government really needs to get going on next gen, and that a new air traffic control system could really bring about some fuel savings. When I saw Gary Kelly speak a couple weeks ago, when they tested out R&P, that saved about 6% on fuel. And if you multiply that an entire domestic system, that's a lot of fuel you're saving.
You're right, and that's a very good point, Dan. But of course, the rest of the system needs to be ready to be able to take that on.
I agree. I just feel that the government has failed in this area.
Yeah, but you know, we keep talking about it. But I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, sorry, I just said in this area.
Oh yeah, good. Did you ever work for the government, Ben?
No, I'm thinking of working for the TSA, but no, other than that.
I used to work for the government, so that's what made me completely crazy on them. But no, it's a good point. And we've been talking about this next gen system for how long? And there, the last estimates I saw were that they think they'll have it running by, you know, what, I don't know, 2020 or 2025 or something like that. Oh my gosh. What happens in the next 15 years?
Yeah, it's too long. But that has been the consistent drumbeat or position of the ATA, is that, like you say, this is an issue that needs to be addressed through the application of next-gen air traffic control technologies. They've been very, very consistent on that.
Sure, and who would have ever thought that the business aviation community would have ever found anything they could agree with the ATA on? But they do.
Yeah.
You know, and actually we should say that nice thing, ATA has actually kind of backed off a little bit from beating up corporate airplanes as the bad guys. Of course, the public in general is beating up business airplanes, so I guess ATA figures they have someone else to do the work for them now.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Rob, because, again, just to go back to the speech I saw a couple weeks ago, when Gary Kelly was talking about these initiatives, he said, you know, we need to work with general aviation on this as a whole. And I found that really surprising, but also I thought that was good.
Yeah, it's refreshing.
I do think it is. I would never have imagined it happening. That's why when I saw it too, I was just amazed. But anyway.
Okay, we just wanted to mention an article from the Wall Street Journal on the Air France crash. This is titled "Computer Failures Are Probed in Jet Crash." Aviation investigators running out of time to find the black boxes with the key information on the crash of Air France Flight 447 suspect the rapid chain of computer and equipment malfunctions stripped the crew of automation today's pilots typically rely on to control a jetliner. And basically, this is still a lot of speculation, but it's based on sort of the limited facts that are out there right now, but the speculation is that we saw sort of a cascading series of failures or issues that together combined to cause this terrible accident.
Do you know what's really scary is that when I heard this, and in fact I'm the one that contributed that piece in there, but I remember an accident. Oh, this must be 20 years ago, maybe 25, of a freight crew. Stalled a 727 because they had a pitot freeze over, And of course the instrumentation was not near as sophisticated as it is now, but the airspeed indicator, because they reread the cockpit voice tapes, said, oh my gosh, the speed's going crazy, we're going so fast. So the captain pulled back on the yoke and pitched the airplane up really, really steeply, and eventually the airplane stalled because the airspeed indicator was lying. And it's a training issue, because what you're taught, even in a Cessna 150 or a Cherokee, is pitch and power. You set the power in a particular place, and it will give you a particular speed and a particular pitch. I don't care if you cover up all the instruments. And these guys, if that's indeed the case, either forgot that or they didn't know that, because it, you know, again, that's the part that's so scary about the technology, is that you get so dependent on it that something happens and you just freak out and you forget all the basics. Again, I don't know that that's what happened, but if it is, it's just a scary, scary thought.
Is there, here's a silly thought, probably an ignorant thought, but the GPS in my car tells me how fast the car's driving. Can't we do the same thing on an airliner?
Sure. Sure. I mean, if the technology really failed, though, I think what they're saying is that they didn't have any kind of, they don't know how erratic all the technology in the airplane was. They may not have had any kind of airspeed, true airspeed, ground speed readouts, anything. But again, you just know that if I stick the throttles in this position and I hold the airplane level, assuming they could tell where level was, I'm going to fly along at this speed. I don't care what the instruments tell me. That's kind of your backup. That's your fail safe when the equipment breaks.
Well, my fear is that they'll never recover the black boxes, and then we'll be left with speculation and conjecture, which would be unfortunate. But that may be where this ends up.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of those great mysteries that's never going to be solved. I think they said the boxes are in 10 or 12,000 feet of water or something like that.
Deep water and a mountainous seafloor. It's not a flat sandy place in the ocean. It's craggy and mountainous down there.
And that's assuming they're even looking in the right place. I mean, because they've been finding debris all over the place. And I think they're looking in the vicinity of where they found the piece of the vertical stabilizer, assuming that they must have come down in the same, but they may not have. Who knows? That could have been one of the first pieces to go, and they may be looking 10 miles from where the thing actually is. I don't know.
Right.
That's scary.
Okay, moving on to our final news story from Aviation
Week. Do we ever have any happy stories?
Well, you can tell us if this is a happy story. This is Republic in deals with Midwest and Frontier. Republic Airways Holdings unveiled an agreement to acquire Milwaukee-based Midwest for $31 million, the day after revealing the deal to acquire Denver-based Frontier for $108.8 million, aiming to transform Republic because of its belief that the prospects for growth as a fixed-fee regional carrier are limited at best. Is this good news? Is this happy news?
Not if you work for Midwest.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, Midwest was basically – everything was done by Republic except for I think 9 717s were left. And then they announced a few weeks ago that E190s were coming in anyway. So that one didn't shock me a whole bunch, to be completely honest with you.
You know what I'm waiting to hear? I'm waiting to hear – remember we've been talking about who is it the United's going to merge with? Was it going to be Continental or who? And imagine the news one of these days when we find out that Republic is going to merge with United. I mean, these people must have a lot of money. I don't know where it's all coming from, but, I don't know if they're buying it all on a credit card or what.
I just say it's funny you bring up United with this one, because Republic does contract flying for United, and now Republic owns one of United's biggest competitors in the Denver market. And how is that going to change when they have to renew that contract? What's going to happen now?
But I don't get either. It says the prospects are limited for growth. I mean, what prospects would you really want of having of being a real airline? You really want to lose $1 billion, a year, or what exactly is the upside?
That's a good point. what a fall from grace, though, for Midwest. I mean, when you think that as little as maybe even 3 years ago, I mean, they were really considered one of the premier carriers here in the Midwest, and to be sold for basically chicken feed, I mean, it's just it's really a shame.
So are they going to dump the chocolate chip cookies, or are they keeping those and bringing them to Frontier as well?
Well, it is interesting. I wonder what's going to happen because, of course, Midwest has that 2-on-2 seating with the big thick seats, and now that they're going to be in the we really, really need to make money on our flights. Well, I wonder if they'll change their cabins.
If I recall correctly, I think initially, I'm not sure if this development will change it. I think the E190s were going to seat about the exact same number as the 717s, and it was going to have the first class. But I mean, before, didn't they have some aircraft that was like in an all business class configaration for a while? Or am
you
I
mean, Midwest?
Yeah, didn't they have they had the Signature and the Saver service, and then I think they dumped the Signature, right?
I don't know. That's I rely on you airline geeky guys to tell me that. I didn't know that they did.
Well, I think they had some planes that were just in a full Signature layout, and they dumped those. They're still like Signature class. You know what,
did they recently dump that? Or
do you have 5 minutes?
You know, the nice thing about all this, though, is because the airlines have no money, you know, it costs money to reconfigure planes. So that's the one possible upside for those that want to continue having the decent service if they do still have those planes.
Are you looking at Midwest Airlines on the net?
No. The Cranky had an article on this.
That's why he and I get along so well. He's cranky. I'm whiny. It just works out so nicely.
Okay, you know, I forget exactly how it worked. But they cut something.
Well, hold on. Wait a second. Now I'm curious.
Like plain text, I'm looking up on their. Oh, yeah, you know, actually, they don't have all 2-on-2. The 717s have 2-on-2 for about the first 12 rows, and then they go to 2-on-3. But no, and they're not. The seats are not as large in the back. I don't think I realized that.
Well, it used to be, though, I think, that the full plane was Signature. So maybe
that's what I remember. I have to admit, I've never flown them, so but
this is bizarre, though, because it's literally half and half. It seemed, I don't know, that's weird.
Yeah, and the same with the 170s. It looks like it's 2-on-2, but I'm sure they're not huge seats.
Yeah, well, E-170, that's the normal configuration in coach, in my experience.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
First class would be 1-on-2.
Oh, Ben, you fly coach sometimes, really?
Well, no, looking back from E-170 and first on United, no. Yes, I do, unfortunately. What's the upside here, though? I just, the airline industry really sucks when you think about it.
One interesting
thing. That's the
upside? one thing I read is that I saw one article trying to bring comparisons between what Republic is doing now and then when Atlantic Coast decided to become Independence Air, and saying that it's almost a similar thing. What do you guys think about that? Personally, I disagree, but I was wondering what you guys thought.
It's a tough one. I don't know. I just see Republic having a lot of cash at a good time, and it's like any other company out there looking for bargains. I mean, what did you say they paid for Midwest? $30 million?
Or they've offered $31
million. $31 million. The airplanes are worth more than that.
And then they got Frontier for about $109 million. I mean, Frontier, I think that still needs to go through the bankruptcy court, assuming no one else will outbid them. I'm not sure how likely that would be, though.
Hey, once again, our guest tonight is Ben from the 1 Mile at a Time blog. And again, welcome, Ben.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Still great to be here.
It's still great. So tell us, what's the big idea with the blog?
Well, I travel a lot. I do what's called mileage running, which is basically flying for the sole purpose of accumulating airline miles. So I travel about 250,000 miles a year. And I have quite a few adventures between the different flights and different airport experiences. And, I share those on my blog along with, the latest frequent flyer promotions or whatever. For example, last week on a flight, I witnessed a lady – Or I was on a flight where a lady peed in the galley, just in the middle of the galley, and,
on purpose?
It's entertaining. She was on some kind of drugs of some sort. We're not sure.
Hopefully.
But the flight attendants in the back alley of the 757 had a very pleasant flight, obviously.
No doubt.
So, you know, just sharing stories and also, you know, the latest promotions, how to maximize miles. And, you know, that's what I try to do.
Who pays for all the tickets? I mean,
well,
buy them yourself or how do you?
I do buy those myself, and United does pay for those tickets as well through the various vouchers they give me. So,
wow.
You know, I pay most of the taxes.
Things about them?
No. Just, you know, like I said earlier, right now all the United flights are packed, and basically through all the bumps I take, you know, the flights are oversold, so I volunteer. They give me anywhere from, you know, $200 to $600 in vouchers. So, for example, last year, or rather over the past 12 months, I've spent probably $3,000 on travel, and for that I've flown about 250,000 miles. I've earned north of 600,000 to 700,000 miles. So, you know, when you attach a value to those miles, 600,000 miles, that's, you know, about 5 first-class tickets to Asia. That's worth a lot more than, you know, $3,000 to most. So,
wow. That's,
you know, it's a big
cool.
game. You know, and it's a lot of fun. I love flying as well. I'm an airplane geek of sorts, but, you know, I've become a bit more of a mileage geek. I would use another word, but...
Well, is there a word that's better than geek? I don't know.
I would say
I
whore.
I think that just kind of says it all.
Most of us refer to ourselves as mileage whores, but, you know, either
can
way
we
works.
Can we say that?
That's
are we regulated by the FCC, Max?
Oh, okay. That's right. Make sure.
Is that actually is there a club for that?
Well, yeah, flyertalk.com would be the closest you'd have to that. You know, it's basically a website for discussing miles and points, among other things. So, you know, there we have a mileage run forum where you'll see the latest deals. You know, once in a while, the airlines publish mistake fares. A few years back, they had a $51 fare, I believe, to, where was it, Tahiti?
Yes, I remember that.
But, yeah, so once in a while, they have mistakes. There was a sub-$100 fare to Larnaca, Cyprus on Alitalia in business class. Just recently, United had a really good mistake. Not quite as cheap, but given that you earn miles, it was very good. It was $1,400 from the U.S. to Sydney in full fare business class. It was supposed to be $14,000, and then, you know, you could upgrade that to first. So that was quite a deal.
How do you hear about me? Do you monitor fares somehow on an hourly basis that you know about that when it happens?
You know, the fares, I usually actually don't do the mistake fares. I do the normal fares. So, for example, let's say I'm flying – my normal mileage run would be I live in Tampa to somewhere on the West Coast. So, say I'm flying to San Francisco. What I would do is I maximize the mileage. So, I would try to find a routing like, for example, on United, it would be Tampa to Washington, Washington to New York, New York to LA, LA to Sacramento, Sacramento to San Francisco. So, you're turning what would be a, you know, 2,300 – mile nonstop flight into something closer to, you know, 5,000 miles each way.
Oh, wow.
Right.
That's,
and then, you know,
pretty neat.
And then, you know, the more you fly, the higher elite status you get, and in turn, you get more miles. So, you know, it's kind of in this case, in terms of mileage, it's the rich getting richer because, you know, you get more bonuses as you fly more. So
this is one of those situations where United thinks you're somebody that's very important, but you know deep in your heart that you're just...
Oh, absolutely. I unfortunately, United loses money off of me. If I ever have a job where I'm flying paid business class just out of goodwill, I will give it back to United.
What a cool job.
For example, in the past 3 weeks, I've accrued about $1,800 in vouchers just from flights being oversold. So $1,800, that'll pay for, you know, 100,000 miles worth of flying for me nearly.
Now, Ben, you earn all these points. Could you tell us about some of the trips you've taken with?
Okay, of course. Typically, you know, in order to maximize miles, I believe miles are best used for premium international tickets. So either Lufthansa first class or Swiss first class to Europe, or otherwise Singapore Airlines first class or the Thai first class, you know, to Asia. So I've traveled to all over the place in Asia. I've traveled to Singapore, Thailand, Hong Kong, China, South Korea, Japan, Indonesia, etc. And, you know, all over Europe, and basically for cheaper than you would pay for a coach ticket, all in first class. So, you know, it works out well for me. If you don't like sitting in planes for 40 hours in a row, it's not the best idea. But because, you know, typically I'll leave, for example, if I do one of these, I would leave at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning. And I would literally fly nonstop until about 5 p.m. the next day. So I would be on a red eye back to the East Coast, and then I'd hop around the East Coast a bit and fly back down to Tampa.
Now, Ben, just since you mentioned the international awards, just can you share with our listeners the experience of Lufthansa first class, especially that terminal? Just to show
yes, of course.
All those benefits they give everyone.
Absolutely, yes, of course. Lufthansa First Class, as a German, I enjoy. Their seats aren't the best, but of course the food is fantastic. And the best part about Lufthansa, I would say, is their first class terminal in Frankfurt. Frankfurt's one of my least favorite airports in the world as such. But they have the terminal. It's basically it's a separate terminal just for first-class passengers. You know, they have a restaurant in there, basically, day beds, whatever. And then they drive you, and this is the coolest thing for any airplane geek. They drive you in a Mercedes S500 or a Porsche Cayenne on the tarmac right up to the plane. So,
cool.
You know, you stand right under a 747. That's a, you know, pretty cool experience.
This is such a neat idea.
Yeah.
Or for example, my other favorite ground experience has to be Thai Airways in Bangkok. They have a spa in the lounge. It's a legitimate spa, not a Thai, you know. Okay. and, you know, you get an hour massage free, you know, everything's free, of course, you know, or other services, legitimate services. So, you know, it's a lot of fun when you can maximize tickets. And, you know, or for example, next month I'm flying to Istanbul and Hong Kong on Turkish Airways and Swiss. They have a new first class on their product, and that's also on miles as well. And, you know, considering that these tickets would cost probably anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000, and I flew maybe $1,500 worth to get it, you know, I'm quite happy with it.
Yeah, I actually have a question too. Are you hiring?
You know, well, this is a great way to be self-employed in this case.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, that sounds pretty cool.
So, I mean, it is rather time-consuming, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Ben,
do you have a life?
No. Well, I'm a student, actually.
Is it hard to be a student and mileage runner at the same time?
Yeah. Dan says, let me get this information down.
Well, I mean, the challenge is I'm gone most weekends, so while other people are getting drunk on Saturday night, I'm, you know, enjoying a buy-on-board snack box for $6. so it's certainly not as glamorous, at least the domestic flying, as, you know, some might think. But
I think you're getting the better deal.
Oh, I absolutely think so. But explaining it to friends is very challenging because, you know, the concept of flying more basically in order to earn miles for flying less doesn't make a whole lot of sense to most people. Understandably, you know, until you actually look at the numbers or you know, a benefactor of it.
Ben, how long have you been doing this?
Oh, gosh, far too long. 5 years, I want to say.
Okay. So my next question is, since you have this great experience with the world's airlines, can you characterize what flying is like today versus, let's say, a year ago? Is there a difference?
You know, the thing is, because I have status with United, most of these recent changes in the past year haven't affected me too much. You know, the checked bag fees and everything and, you know, all that stuff really doesn't affect me. But I have noticed more and more people bring kitchen sinks aboard airplanes. What else have I seen? I mean, I've seen some crazy stuff that people have brought on the airplane. I've seen someone bring literally a full-sized, you know, probably 32-inch bag aboard, you know, try to fit into the overhead bin. Of course, it didn't fit. And it weighed about 70 pounds, so... You know, mostly just those kind of changes, but nothing major otherwise. And it's sad that when I started flying United, it was when they were in the peak of bankruptcy. And I would have to say the service then was better than it is today, which is somewhat sad. But
interesting.
Oh, well.
So which airline – no, I'm sorry. What I was going to ask, what do you think is the coolest trip that you've taken in the last year?
Well, let's see. If we can go back about 18 months, I loved New Zealand just as a destination. I mean, there's two kinds of trips I take. Some are flying somewhere far away just for the experience. Like once I flew to Singapore for 24 hours and then Bangkok for 24 hours and flew right back. That was just because Singapore Airlines had some first class availability and I wanted to take advantage of it. So that was cool from the flying perspective. But in terms of destinations, my favorite probably have to be New Zealand. Just an incredible country, beautiful country. I loved Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. That was quite an adventure. The biggest challenge the first day was just trying to cross the street because there's no traffic lights and, you know, there's seemingly millions of mopeds and they're all just, you know, they don't stop.
Wow.
So you just kind of got to walk and wait for – well, not wait, just walk and not make eye contact.
Well, you know, let me ask one last question from my standpoint. I mean, speaking as a completely happily married guy, is this a way to meet girls? This is purely a research question. I want to understand that.
I mean, I could say some mean things, but the aviation industry is getting older and older, I think, so.
Yeah.
Not particularly, I would have to say, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I wish, but no.
All right. Well, we want to make sure we leave time for a little game that we play. We tend to play with our guests called word association. And it's actually very simple. We might each have a couple, and we'll take turns and just ask you a word or a phrase, and you just respond with kind of the first thought that comes to your mind. It's just a sort of a conversation starter. Doesn't have to be more than that. So, Dan, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, I have three, but I want to start with my best first. Just to get Ben going, because he said conversation starter. Ben, my first one is Glenn Tilton.
Oh, I'm trying to think of the first word that comes to my head that's not a cuss word or mismanagement, I would have to say.
Ooh.
And that's an understatement, but it's the nicest thing I could say.
Is it repairable, do you think?
With a new CEO. Oh, the word?
No. I mean...
You mean United?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. With a proper management team, I think it absolutely is. The airline has a great legacy. It's just so sad to see they were the first airline to order the 777, and now, you know, they have no new planes on order. And conveniently, they're talking about possibly ordering new planes. It's very convenient that this is around the same time as their union contracts are up for renegotiation. So, I certainly hope they can be fixed, and with a real leader. Like, Southwest or similar line, I'm sure they could recover. But, if it's another greedy, selfish person, I doubt.
Okay. All right. Rob, do you have a word for Ben?
Yes. Well, this isn't – does it count if it's a phrase? I mean, it's –
No, phrases
it's
are acceptable.
Oh. Laboratory blue juice.
Swish. Oh, gosh. I don't know what to say. Eek.
Eek. Okay. Good. Got an eek on him.
I have heard from flight attendants that, for the airlines that do have the blue juice stuff, that sitting in the rear galley of the 757 is rather unpleasant during takeoff and landing because apparently there's quite a bit of swishing in the tank.
Oh, slosh.
Wonderful.
Yes. Sloshing, yes, yeah, back yeah. and forth. So, yeah, okay. No thanks.
All right.
Ben, how about good airline service?
Asian Airlines.
Yeah, consistently. Big difference, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the service culture is completely different. Any Asian airline almost that I can think of tops basically any airline from any other part of the world for the most part.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I've flown on Singapore, JAL, ANA, and it really is a very different kind of an experience.
It absolutely is, and both in terms of looks and, more importantly, in terms of service.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but can you guys explain something to me? I understand what you're saying about Asian airline service, but then why is the service in a Chinese restaurant so bad?
Actually, I think Chinese airlines would be the one exception to the good
yes.
Asian
okay.
service
all right,
rule.
Good point.
I have flown Air China, and it was not a pleasant experience at all.
All right. Thank you.
Dan, have another one?
I do have another one. Rhapsody
Scary.
In Blue.
United, that's, yeah. Man, from listening to Rhapsody in Blue on hold with United all the time, that's the one thing I associate that song to, or melody.
How many times have you heard that song, do you think?
Oh, gosh. It's getting to the point I really used to love that, but I'm starting to really not at all like it anymore. It's sad because for all the time – well, the real issue is, though, now United has their call centers outsourced. So when you're on hold with the Indian call center, it's a really bad connection, and they're playing Rhapsody in Blue, and it's an awful version, and it doesn't sound anything like the real thing. So nowadays, I actually associate Rhapsody in Blue more with the Indian call centers that United has.
Can I tell you something that you have to look forward to as an old guy? This conversation sounds a bit to me like hearing the song that you used to love when your ex-wife were still courting. And now it's just painful.
Well, I guess you consider United my wife with the amount of time I spend with her. So not yeah. ex-wife yet, but we'll see.
I have one, and then we'll go to Dan. Real job.
I don't know what to say.
How about you don't want one?
Yeah. Exactly, yes. No, thanks.
Find a way to make this pay, and I think you're set.
Real job, not the airline industry, for the most part.
Oh, so really? So you don't want to march off in that direction, huh?
Oh, I absolutely do, but I don't want a real job.
Okay.
I mean, the jobs in the airline industry are certainly real, but when you think of, for the most part, the job insecurity, the lack of pay, and just overall, working for one company for 30 years, and then when they cut your benefits, you're screwed. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to go work for a different airline, at least if you're unionized, so it's tough.
Your opinion may change by the time you graduate, but I can certainly understand it.
Oh, well.
All right, Dan, you have one more? Or is that it?
Yes, I do. This might take more than one word, Ben, to explain your feelings, though, but Star Alliance.
Oh, gosh. Global, I would say. Star Alliance is, I think, by far the most global and global airline alliance, and we see now that, you know, they're trying to, I guess, invite basically every airline in the world. I think there was recently an article about that, how they're trying to, their target is 50 airlines, so they're certainly more extensive than SkyTeam or Oneworld, and I would say overall they have better airlines than any other program or alliance. And we won't get into whatever else I can say about them.
Okay, Rob, do you have one more?
No, I think I've interrupted the other two enough that, you know, I'll just pass my turn.
Okay, so then we'll just close with a traditional phrase, just simply, Ben, when you hear the term airplane geeks, what does that mean to you?
Cool, I have to say. I like airplane geeks, and anyone that, you know, I guess it goes back to the whole nerd versus geek battle, but I'm right in the middle. I support both you guys, and it's, you know, not that I'm not, so cool is my word.
All right, very good. Ben, tell us where folks can find your blog.
Yes, at onemileatatime.net or through boardingarea.com, and, you know, click on the thing and you'll see 1 mile at a time.
Great, and thanks again for joining us. We really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks so much. It was great
to
be on.
Ben.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Cool life.
And now with aviation news from the only country that can call itself a continent, here's Steve Vischer with the Australia News Desk.
Dateline, June 27th, 2009.
Well, g'day folks, it's Steve Fisher here at the Airplane Geeks Australia desk, and with me is Grant as always. G'day, Grant.
G'day, Steve. How you going, mate?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks, mate. There's certainly been no shortage of aviation stories in Australia to choose from this week. Here's a selection of the best ones. And this first story appeared in the Herald Sun newspaper. That's heraldsun.com.au, of course. And the biggest story this week concerns Qantas cancelling an order for Boeing Dreamliner aircraft. The article by Jeff Easdown and reads, Qantas has put Boeing on notice over the troubled 787 Dreamliner by cancelling 15 orders and deferring the delivery of another 15 planes. The decision shores up the carrier's balance sheet, saving $3 billion in aircraft payments at a time when the airline is bleeding cash because of the global financial crisis. The Herald Sun was told that Qantas can expect to recover another $200 million the Boeing charged to reserve slots on the 787 assembly line in Seattle, but the cancellations and deferrals will deny Jetstar the planes it needs to pursue its aggressive growth plan for Asia. The Dreamliner was to be the plane that flew budget-conscious Australians to new destinations such as Seoul, Chinese cities, and on to southern Europe. Jetstar was to get the first of a fleet order of 15 Dreamliners next May, but it's been told that it won't get the first 787 before the last quarter of 2013, 7 years after the jets were first expected to arrive here in Australia. Yesterday, just days after Boeing admitted to a wing box failure, it said it was cancelling its order for 15 larger long-haul 787-9 series jets and deferred the order for 15 smaller 787-8 series jets that Jetstar was to get.
That's pretty full-on stuff, mate.
That obviously speaks to some pretty major flaws there in the 787's development program, which is probably not unexpected.
Well, it's as I mentioned to you before, mate, it's the for Boeing to actually put that first flight back, it's got to be something really serious because they would have been pushing everything they could to get that puppy in the air. So yeah, it's got to be a big issue to actually keep it on the ground, because as we're seeing here with Qantas, it gives the airlines leverage to be able to say, well, you're not fulfilling your side of the bargain, we're walking away.
It certainly does, and it says here further on in the article too that Qantas has seen its full year profit slump to between $100 and $200 million Australian, which would certainly be an amount of money that would look good in my bank account, but it's probably not much when you're running an airline.
Yeah, I'm not an airline of Qantas Group size, but I know the comments have been made that Jeff Dixon, the previous CEO, is probably sitting on the sidelines going, phew, thank God I'm out of there, because Alan Joyce, the new CEO, has got a pretty hot bucket of water that he's fallen into.
One of the other comments that was made here in the article is that Jetstar may have to look at leasing some aircraft that are grounded and in storage at the moment. Having a look at some lists of stored aircraft that I found on speednews.com, it seems there's no shortage of narrow and wide-body jets. For instance, there appears to be close on 80 767 aircraft perfectly usable but are in storage at the moment now.
Well, I wonder how many of those are ex-Qantas 767s.
Well, we know at least four of them are, but maybe they could get those aircraft back, or, I mean, they'd could grab some off BA as they've done in the past.
Yeah, anything's possible.
Anything's possible. And with Qantas, they're never short of generating news for us here in Australia.
Funny you should mention that, because I've got another Qantas story to go here. This one is printed in The Australian from Teresa Oi. I believe that's how I say her name. Basically, Qantas is causing a bit of a stink with the Australian and International Pilots Association. As we just mentioned, they have recently put a few 767s into mothballs that were being used on the Trans-Tasman between Australia and New Zealand. And now they've just gone and turned around and wet-leased a Boeing 767 freighter. So not so much the aircraft, but more so much the pilots. They've just put these their own 767s out, the passenger ones, and they've forced 50 pilots to take extended leave. And then they've turned around and they've wet-leased a 767 freighter with crew because that's cheaper than using local crew to fly it.
That will be a big issue for Qantas pilots. There is a great divide in that group between Jetstar pilots and Qantas pilots in terms of the way their employment contracts are structured. They certainly get a lot more flexibility out of Jetstar pilots and probably pay them a lot less too. Qantas pilots are on a good deal, and you can't blame them for wanting to protect that.
That's why they're one of the reasons they're trying to push a lot of into Jetstar, because it makes their life so much easier.
Yes, and I know you mentioned Jeff Dixon earlier. He would never shy away from an issue like this. It'll be interesting to see how Alan Joyce handles touchy issues such as this one.
Indeed.
And moving into our next story here, Grant, looks like we've got a bit of closure for the previously stranded A340 here in Melbourne.
As we were saying last week, Emirates A340 had a tail strike down here in Melbourne, and indications were that the aircraft was still in Melbourne. Well, it seems that within a day of us recording our last session, the aircraft actually left Melbourne. They estimate it's going to cost $100 million to repair the jet. This is an article from news.com.au, and it's by Jeff Easdown, and it's got a nice little photo here of the bum of the A340 with a very nasty skid mark right the way along it, including the broken bits. As I mentioned, Emirates are expecting to pay $100 million to repair this aircraft. Now, to get it out of Melbourne, because it had the rear bulkhead fractured, they couldn't pressurize it. So they're flying all the way back to Toulouse from Melbourne, Australia, at less than 12,000 feet. This thing's going to go through a lot of fuel on its way.
It's going to be a long, slow flight, and gee whiz, Grant, those crews will certainly be earning some overtime when they get back.
Oh, yeah. They're actually going to take the entire tail and the last two sections of the fuselage off so that they can replace the fractured rear bulkhead. So this is really big.
Interestingly, too, from an airplane geek's point of view, I noticed that aircraft departed using an Airbus call sign, or an Airbus flight number, rather, than using a Emirates flight number.
Yeah, no, they've had a whole lot of French pilots and engineers down here working on it, getting ready to ferry it. I reckon it's going to take 4 days and use, quote, copious quantities of fuel. They're going to go from Melbourne to Bali to Singapore to Dubai and to Cairo before finally getting to France.
And just briefly, Grant, one more quick article here that we found in the business section of the Australian newspaper this week, something that we'll just mention briefly here now and keep an eye on for future reports. Talking about our friends across the Tasman at Air New Zealand, they've been urged to consider an alliance with Virgin Blue. It says here to cut costs and create a stronger competitor to Qantas. It's according to a report by Macquarie Bank analysts. They're saying a tie-up through a takeover or significant investment by Air New Zealand in Virgin Blue would improve profitability on routes and save money by eliminating engineering, maintenance, and duplication. So, yeah, rather interesting proposal there. Can't see it happening myself, but if there's any further movement on that issue, we'll be sure to let you know. And those were the pick of the articles from this week, in a week where we did have quite a smorgasbord of articles to choose from. We hope you enjoyed those ones. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
And we'll talk to you all again next week. Bye-bye.
Luego.
Okay, we are very happy to receive a recording from one of our listeners, Stephen Tornblum, and we'll let you have a listen to that. Steve is from, I believe, California, so if this works out and he comes through again next week, then we may have just created the California desk of the Airplane Geeks podcast, but we'll see. Here it is.
Hello, fellow Airplane Geeks. This is Stephen Tornblum coming to you from sunny and warm Southern California. I have some quick news bits and a couple aircraft for you to keep an eye out for while you're at the airport. On Monday, June 22nd, Virgin Atlantic celebrated its 25th anniversary in style by recreating the first flight to New York that departed on June 22nd, 1984. Sir Richard Branson, president of Virgin Atlantic, was joined on board by frequent travelers, travel trade VIPs, and a host of special guests. After American Airlines announced last week they will be dropping their, quote, Nerdbird flights between the technology cities of San Jose, California, and Austin, Texas, Alaska Airlines announced this week they will be adding the San Jose to Austin route to their network starting September 25th using 737-800 aircraft. Republic Airways Holdings has agreed to be the equity sponsor of Frontier Airlines' plan of reorganization. The plan, which is subject to bankruptcy court approval and various conditions, would allow Republic to purchase 100% of the equity in the reorganized company for only $108 million. Also this week, Republic Airways Holdings announced it will acquire the remaining shares of Midwest Airlines from TPG Capital. When completed in about 4 to 6 weeks, Republic will control 100% of Midwest stock, just like the Frontier announcement the day before, and this, of course, is also subject to bankruptcy court approval. Boeing issued a press release this week today postponing again the 787 Dreamliner first flight due to newly discovered problems. The manufacturer is probably facing additional cancellations, possibly Qatar Airways and Virgin Atlantic Airways. The date of June 29th at 12.04 p.m. was set on this podcast by John Ostrower in episode 41 and sadly will not happen. Some new aircraft to keep your eye out for if you're at the airport. Continental Airlines announced this week that it is taking delivery of another new Boeing 737-900ER, which is painted in a retro livery to commemorate the airline's 75th anniversary on July 15, 2009. The new aircraft's retro livery, which was originally used on aircraft beginning in 1947 and is called the Blue Skyway, was selected by Continental employees. JetBlue Airways has added decals to one of their Airbus A320s in support of the Real Salt Lake soccer team, of which JetBlue is a big sponsor. American Airlines has painted one of their 777-200ERs into a one-world scheme, with the fuselage being bare metal and the titles forward of the wing. And last, the first Embraer E195 for Ukrainian company Windrose was rolled out of paint in Amsterdam this week. The color scheme is graced on the left side by some nice details of a historic building. That's all for now. I'll be back next week, hopefully, with some more news and some new aircraft for you guys to keep an eye out for. Until then, have a good week.
That's great. We thank Stephen for submitting that. And certainly if anyone else would like to do something similar, then just drop us a line, send us an email, and let's talk.
I got to say, I'm glad you mentioned that Continental livery because I just love those retro schemes. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
Yeah, I saw one that was an American retro back to the what did they call them when the 707s first came out? I think Astrojets or something. And it was that thin red line along the silver fuselage, and they did it on a 737, and it was very cool. It really was, yeah.
I love to see United do one.
Oh, and the white fuselage with the red, white, and blue on the tail or something, or
the one they had in the Caravelle.
Oh yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, no one even knows what a Caravelle is. Do you realize that?
A long time ago. Well, Stephen is a bit of a plane spotter, I believe. So hopefully we can look forward to kind of that angle in his reports, which should be fun. Dan, I think, has a very interesting site that he's run across or he's familiar with.
Well, a friend of mine passes along to me, and the website I found is widgetheads.net, and as you can probably guess, it's dedicated to all things Delta. And I mean, they definitely have some very cool stats when it comes to the merger. When they have a very interesting list just tracking the repainting of the Northwest fleet. They have a whole list of the airports and how the rebranding is going. Really, just a lot of cool stuff, in my opinion. So they have a really, really cool timeline of the company. So I think I think it's just a cool website to play around with, at least for a little bit.
Widgetheads.net?
Yes.
That's a pretty cool name. Okay, cool.
Very good. Thanks to Dan for that. We also have our This Week in Aviation segment. I think Dan, again, is on to give us that information.
Yeah, this is going to be great because there's a bunch of French words and you're going to laugh at me because I can't pronounce them, and it's going to be great.
Do you want me to do it next week? I mean, you know, you are in college, you know. The goal is to stretch yourself. So start stretching, baby.
Well, thank you for that support, Rob.
Okay.
Once again, this comes from David Vanderhoof from Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, and this is This Week in Aviation, Volume 1, Episode 4, June 22nd to July 4th, 2009, and I can't believe the summer has flown this fast already. On June 28th, 1909, and this is the stuff with lots of French, so prepare to be amused, the first Concorde Aviation, or Exhibition of Aerial Locomotion, was held at the Grand Palais in Paris. The exhibition was organized by André Granet and Robert Esnault-Pelletier. Yeah. Needless to say, there wasn't much flying, as it was held indoors, which was pretty interesting. On July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean. Noonan was a navigator and actually a merchant marine sailor and had worked for Pan Am, setting up the routes and bases for the China Clipper flights. The Lockheed L-10E Electric took off from the island of Lay and with the destination of Howard Island. The USS Coast Guard cutter Itasca was assigned to be the radio beacon for the leg of the trip. Howard Island, according to Wikipedia, is 6,500 feet long, 1,600 feet wide, and 10 feet above sea level, which is, interestingly, slightly bigger than a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, which has a length of 1,115 feet with a beam width of 257 feet, and it has GPS. Landing on an aircraft carrier is easier than what they were trying to do. The mystery still exists why they never arrived. I'll leave those details for the next episode of History's Mysteries.
But you know what's really interesting, see, about an aircraft carrier is if you're lost, it can come and find you.
This is true.
It kind of brings the, you know, it's not, they didn't have that advantage.
That's right.
On June 30th, 1977, President Jimmy Carter canceled the B-1A strategic bomber. The program was started in 69 by the Nixon administration. Excuse me. Carter had campaigned against the B-1, saying the B-1 bomber is an example of a proposed system which should not be funded and would be wasteful of taxpayers' dollars. The cost at the time would have been $100 million per copy. At the time, the Carter administration stated that the cancellation was due to the fact that the ALCM, also known as air-launched cruise missiles, were a much more effective and cheaper alternative to the manned bomber. The real reason was to fund a new program, albeit clandestinely called the Advanced Tactical Bomber. The ATB eventually led to the B-2A Spirit stealth bomber, which ironically came out to be $737 million per copy. Only the Pentagon would consider that a cost savings. And then, this week in World War II, June 20th, 1939, the HE-162 was the first aircraft to fly using a liquid-fuel rocket for propulsion. Eric Warsitz was the pirate. Not the pirate, the pilot.
Did he wear a patch?
On July 4th, 1942, was the first American bombing mission over enemy-occupied Europe. The mission was undertaken by the 15th Bombardment Squadron flying Douglas A-20C Havocs. The targets were Luftwaffe airfields in the occupied Netherlands. Two aircraft did not return. The date was chosen a morale booster by General Hap Arnold and approved by FDR. And this is an in memoriam section. Last week we lost Ed McMahon. Ed was an accomplished pilot himself. He was a product of the V-5 program. Training in Texas as a civilian, he ended up doing intermediate training at Pensacola. After earning his wings and commission in the U.S. Marine Corps, he was sent to Corsair School. Upon completion of training, he heard something no fighter pilot wants to hear. You, son, are going to be an instructor. He stayed with the operational training unit in Florida until August of 1945, never to go overseas. Before he was mustered out in February 1946, he was also on the F-7F-1 Tiger Cat test program and was discharged with 6 air medals. McMahon was called back to active duty when the Korean War broke out. He flew 85 missions in an OE-1, the naval designation for the Cessna 305A, as forward air controller. He was discharged from Korea as colonel. Lastly, McMahon retired as a brigadier general in the California Air National Guard, and he had a life in flight beyond his high-flying career in entertainment.
Boy, I had no idea.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking the same thing. I had no idea that McMahon was even a pilot. Wow.
And then the first flights that occurred during the week of June 28th to July 4th, on June 30th, 68, was the Lockheed C-5A Galaxy. On the 27th of 36, it was a Lockheed L-12 Electra Jr. On the 28th of 42, it was the Grumman F-6F Hellcat. On June
9th, 1995. It was the first flight of the Bell 407 or ARH-70. And although that program was canceled by the U.S. Army, David notes Iraq is scheduled to purchase 70 of them. And the first flight for the Douglas DC-1 was on July 1st, 1933. And that's the way it was, June 28th to July 4th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, Airplane Geeks Historian, and you can reach David at airplanegeekhistorian@gmail.com.
Oh, nicely done, Dan.
Even yeah, except for the French stuff.
No. It's better than I would have guessed.
I was impressed, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Rob. I'm here to please.
Well, yeah, and our goal is to make you warm and fuzzy.
Very good. All right, that about wraps it up. Again, we'd like to thank our guest, Ben, from One Mile at a Time. Ben, again, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Keep racking up those miles, baby.
Yeah. A quick shout-out, if I might. Saturday, June 27th, there was a meetup for the Uncontrolled Airspace podcast listeners. This was held at Barnes Airport in Massachusetts. Some of the listeners flew in and some of them drove because actually the weather was a bit threatening and they're worried about being stranded. Jack Hodgson was there and some other really cool UCAP listeners I got to meet. One of them was Ed, who I think also goes by Turbo, I think. And he actually arrived in his Robinson R-44 helicopter and he took some of us up for about a one-hour tour of the Massachusetts and Connecticut countryside. And let me tell you, this was about the coolest thing I've done in a long time. I think I'm going to start thinking of myself as a helicopter geek after this. So special thanks to Ed for a great introductory flight. So that about wraps it up. Rob, how can folks find you online?
Usually in dark corners and, you know, places that other people don't normally hang out. No, they can find us at jetwine.com, and I really want to be thinking, let's see, this is now the 28th of June as we're recording this. That means that Oshkosh Air Venture starts in less than a month. So I hope we're going to be doing something about sort of a pre-Air Venture show.
Yeah, we'll do something special.
Cool. Okay.
There's a lot going on that, and everybody is getting pumped up for that. So.
I'm getting pumped up just tonight, just listening to it. But then it doesn't take much for me. So
that's what we hear.
Yeah,
Dan, how do people find
again,
you?
Huh? Okay, sorry.
You can watch me. Read me make a fool of myself on a daily basis at Things in the Sky at thingsinthesky.com, and I'm actually on a boarding area with Ben. And you can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Very good. You can follow the Airplane Geeks as well, just simply as Airplane Geeks. Folks can also visit us at airplanegeeks.com, leave a comment. You can also order a t-shirt. You can write us at thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com, or you can leave voicemail at area code 812-757-4252.
I always forget to tell people that Jetwine is on Twitter at Jetwine also. So you guys are always ahead of me on that.
That's very good. Okay. So join us next week as we talk airplanes.
It's assuming we come back, unless they come and get us.
I hope not. Bye, everybody.
It's all in the Zen.
Doesn't meet any girls, though. That's doesn't sound like much of a life for a college guy.